Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for being here. It's good to see a nice big crowd interested in liberty and the public square. I'm Kevin Roberts, the president of Wyoming Catholic College, traveling the state this week very happily talking about one of my favorite subjects, which is liberty and states' rights and what you and I need to do to preserve both. The ancient Greeks said that any speaker needed to establish his or her credibility. So I should say on the subject that I did grow up in Louisiana, not liking Abraham Lincoln and loving states' rights, but I am a trained historian. I went to the University of Texas, where I think we liked Abraham Lincoln and probably didn't like states' rights. It sort of leans a little bit to the left. And I don't lean a little bit to the left. I lean a lot the other direction. But I'm here tonight, first and foremost, to speak objectively as, I won't say an expert, maybe a specialist, in the founding of the country, and also how people of faith should live out their faith in the public square. So it is a great honor to be here, and also on behalf of the college, I just want to express our gratitude for all of you supporting the college in this way. As you know, we're the only private four-year college in Wyoming. We offer a world-class education, which first and foremost focuses on the human person and the development of the human person. And that is going to be at the center of my comments tonight. So there will be a lot of commentary about political science, about how government works, about how people behave, about liberty. But ultimately, all of those components go back to recognizing the full dignity of the human person. So we would have some more people here from the college tonight, but I'm happy to report that we are welcoming our largest freshman class in our history, 42 students. We will have a record enrollment this fall. And we have twice the number of high school students from around the country participating in our summer program, which we call PEAK, this summer than we did last summer. So we are, by God's grace, in the beginning of a major growth cycle. It is a great, great blessing to be at the head of the college. Last month, you had someone who you know well, Professor Kyle Washit, who is now our Dean of Students. And Professor Washit focused on the question, if you want a virtuous republic, what kinds of citizens do you need? And, of course, the answer is virtuous ones. And as Kyle does a good job of every day in his life modeling, you start that with the relationships around you. You start that by building strong communities, which I think the college has probably done in Lander. Next month, you will have a renowned scholar, Virginia Arbery, who's an expert, I can use that word in her case, an expert in the Federalist Papers, also an expert in what we might call the rule of law. And what Jenny will advocate next month in her lecture is that in order to have a virtuous republic, in order to have virtuous citizens, there has to be an understanding and appreciation for the rule of law. And so my job tonight is to sort of link the two. And the way the three of us have decided that I will link the two is to talk about the 10th Amendment, to talk about state sovereignty, and to talk about a massive imbalance between state power and federal power. When Mike was interviewing me, and thank you, Mike, for doing that to promote this event, I think he was suggested that he was a little leery of the title. And I came up with a title that would be jarring because we ought to be jarred by what we are examining. So I will begin tonight by sending us back 5 years in time to 2009. And at that time, the governor of Texas, who's still the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, used a word that got him in trouble. Secession. Secession. He wasn't advocating it. He wasn't saying that Texas was going to secede. He wasn't saying that as governor he was going to propose to the legislature that there be articles of secession drawn up. He wasn't even advocating something less nuclear, if you will, than secession, nullification. He simply used the word. And the national media, or at least many in the national media, excoriated Perry for simply using the word. And I think that that flashpoint, that example, helps us to understand a number of the problems that we face. Not only do we face a problem in the content, which is that the federal government has overreached at the expense of states, which means at the expense of our liberty. But we can't even have a conversation about the content, because if you were to say that, you were made out to be a kook and a loon. And this is why Wyoming Catholic College, sort of discerning its own obligation to the people of Wyoming, wants to be a lot more vocal about sharing some of the things that we have studied and some of the things we think about in Lander. And one need not be Catholic, of course, in order to appreciate this. Someone could be an atheist and agree with everything, or at least almost everything, that we're going to say in these lectures. And I would like to see more of our brother and sister schools, whether they be Catholic or not, do the same sort of thing, because what's happened for too long, for about half a century, is that those of us who have a proper understanding of liberty, a proper understanding of limited government, have been too quiet. And what has resulted is a situation like Governor Perry experienced 5 years ago, in which it sounds as if he's from, or the media wants to make it sound as if he's from the early 19th century, waving a Confederate flag and all of the images, of course, that the media wants to evoke by saying that. And ultimately, in spite of the fact that Governor Perry suffered a very unfortunate memory lapse in a presidential campaign, he's something of a scholar when it comes to federalism and states' rights and an understanding of limited government. That's not an endorsement. That's not why I'm here. But I think it's good for us to think about electing public officials at every level who have an understanding about that. That'll be one of the solutions that I will offer. So what this talk does not propose is that the state of Wyoming secede from the Union. What this talk does not propose, at least in the near term, is that the state legislature in Cheyenne nullify federal laws, although if I had my druthers, I would pick a couple and ask them to do that on behalf of our college. One of them would be Obamacare, because our religious liberties, were it not for a couple of temporary injunctions that we have received, would be tremendously violated, and you ought to know we will never kowtow to a government that tells us what to believe, not simply because that's our right, but because it's your right too, and I don't want your rights infringed either. So in spite of the fact that self-interest would suggest that perhaps we ought to be advocating at least nullification, that's not what I'm going to be advocating. But what I do want to propose tonight is that there is a series of several steps that we can take locally and at the state level and at the national level that can do a couple of things. The first thing it can do is perhaps begin to push back against this federal overreach in a very peaceful way, perhaps even in a cheerful way. But the second thing it can do is begin to diminish our frustration. And that's the thing that I see in here as I travel around the state and travel around the country, typically on college business, as people say, Kevin, we love colleges like yours and many others because they give us hope. They give us optimism. And of course, the hope and optimism comes from the wonderful students we have and the wonderful students that colleges like ours around the country have. But we have to be careful that if we focus so much on analyzing problems and don't talk enough about solutions, and then don't take those steps as individuals to solve the problems, we can, in fact, become very frustrated. And so I want to be sure that in the lecture tonight, as well as in what I hope will be a vibrant, robust Q&A session that follows, that you leave here slightly, at least slightly more optimistic than you were walking in. We start with the text of the Tenth Amendment, which I have put on the outline there for you. And I give you this outline because there will be a quiz after the lecture, which is only 5 hours long. So thanks for giving me half of the day. One of those is a joke. I'll let you decide which one. The Tenth Amendment reads, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people." There are a number of things to understand in that short, pithy sentence. And one of the things that I'll be doing as we flow through this outline is unpacking the Tenth Amendment as we go along. It's very important to understand 5 or 6 points about the Tenth Amendment. In a lot of ways, all of the other information that you see there on this page is related to a full understanding of the history of the Tenth Amendment, the context of it, and also its modern application. So I will return to the Tenth Amendment explicitly several times over the next half hour or so, not 5 hours. But let's first deal with our modern circumstances. I'm a big believer that if we're going to be cheerful warriors, which we ought to be, and warriors, I hope, just figuratively, that we have to be honest about the problems in front of us. In other words, if we were not to be honest in assessing the problems around us, then our optimism would be empty, and we wouldn't really solve anything. In fact, I think a lot of the frustrations that Americans feel about the political process and the political system comes from that. That we're not really ever, it seems, as a country, as a state, as a community, analyzing the problems around us. Well, I'm a realist and I'm blunt. It's the way I was raised, and this is Wyoming, so here we go. The first argument is that we have an expansive federal government that has usurped the powers of the people. There is federal tyranny. I defy someone to prove me wrong on that. And that federal tyranny can be exemplified in one way by looking at powers that we used to have, that used to be protected, primarily by state governments. That's the crux of the argument. And those have been usurped. I'm not using nuclear language just to be hyperbolic. I'm using it because it's accurate. I've already mentioned, or at least alluded to, the HHS mandate. It doesn't matter what you think about the Catholic Church's position on contraception. It's our right to believe that. It's your right not to believe that. And it's our right in a church or in a college or in a family to practice what we want. It's not harming anyone. I would argue in a different setting it's helping society, but we don't even have to do that. This is not an explicitly Catholic position. It is our right to hold that. And we have a government now in which the executive branch, by executive fiat, has taken legislative action and defined it in a far more nefarious way. Because keep in mind, the HHS mandate is an executive interpretation of legislative law. If that had been attempted as recently as 50 or 60 years ago, you would have had some state legislatures say, we are going to talk about nullification, or we're just going to ignore it if we're not going to use the word nullification. And this is why, thank goodness, that Hobby Lobby has taken the lead, Little Sisters of the Poor, many Catholic and non-Catholic entities obviously fighting this, because it has a lot more to do with other issues beyond the key issue of contraception. It has everything to do with religious liberty and with conscience rights. And of course, keep in mind where rights come from. They don't come from government, in spite of the fact that 3/4 of American adults say that. Our rights come from government. No, they don't. Our rights come from nature. And if you call yourself a Christian, then you would say they come from God. Period. Government exists at our pleasure. What about the EPA? I love the environment. I love being a steward in the environment. But the EPA has gone well beyond its core mission when it was established in the early 1970s. So much so that, as you may be aware, there are 263 armed law enforcement officers of the EPA who can enter your home or my home without a search warrant. And this is a big deal in the West, where there are so many federal lands. This is a big deal in Fremont County, as you may be aware. And so, these are examples of administrative overreach. We start with a law that may or may not be good, and the executive branch and its ascending power over the last 50 or 60 years has come to usurp our rights. Keep in mind, for example, the Magna Carta in 1215. It's part of our intellectual and political heritage. One of the reasons that the nobles forced the king, and they did force the king to sign it, by the way, to sign the Magna Carta is because they were tired of his henchmen coming onto their private property doing what? Illegal search and seizure without a warrant. They were tired of not being given a writ of habeas corpus, which means if you're jailed, you have to be formally charged within 24 hours. This is an 800-year-old tradition in England and now the United States. And actually, we can find elements of this going all the way back to ancient Hebrew civilization. We are, and we ought to be proud of this as Americans, we are descendants of that tradition. And here in the 21st century, we might be living in a time when these have been violated, these rights have been violated in particularly egregious ways. And I don't have to say much about the NSA other than, as recently as 3 years ago, when very mainstream commentators went around the country talking about the possibility that the NSA was using surveillance of our cell phones, that they were building drones, they were presented as the craziest people who've ever talked on the planet. And of course, we know that it's true. I'm not suggesting that every seemingly crazy idea we read about is true, but I am suggesting that it has become difficult even to have just a rational discourse about this. So the problem goes even beyond the fact that our rights have been usurped. Secondly, the expansive federal government has usurped the powers of the state. This is a very, it's crucial that you understand the link between this first argument and the second, because it used to be that, say, starting with the founding of the country all the way until the 1950s or 60s, that as an American civilization, we understood that it was state governments who protected our rights. They protected our rights. Even the state governments didn't give them to us. But our founders, when they established the country in the 1770s and 80s, see state governments as the guarantors, as the protectors of liberty or the protectors of rights. And so if the powers of states are being abridged or usurped, as a consequence, our powers, our rights are being abridged. And keep in mind what the Tenth Amendment says. The founders could have said, well, we're going to have one amendment like the Tenth that's focused on states, and we're going to have another amendment that's focused on the people. In other words, you could have one amendment that says any power not given to the federal government is reserved to the states, and you could have an additional one that says any power not given to the federal government is given to the people. But they go together. They go hand in hand. And the reason is because of sovereignty, which I will come back to in a moment. What are examples of this? Imagine being a border governor today, a border state governor, and swearing an oath to protect your people. And there is an invasion, which is sponsored by our federal government. I think immigration is a great thing. I'm glad there's immigration in the history of our country. Otherwise, from the looks of all of us, we might not be here. I believe we have a moral obligation to anyone in our communities. But I also believe that all of that is useless if there isn't a rule of law and if there isn't a government protecting that rule of law. Because otherwise, the liberty of those newly arrived people is meaningless. They would be coming into a society that doesn't protect their basic rights. And so I have great sympathy for the border state governors, regardless of the political party they're in. I mean, this is something that I think ought to transcend political affiliations. What about Medicaid and highway funds? Both of these sources of federal dollars to states come with strings attached. And many times in the last 25 years and beyond, but particularly in the last 25 years, Congress has said, we want state X to do Y, and if it doesn't, then we're holding back those Medicaid funds. Or you're not getting highway funds. As if money that's coming from our pockets funneled through our state revenue system up to Washington, D.C., can be held hostage. Because we're behaving in a different way than what some people in Washington want us to behave. And if I really wanted to sort of get you excited, I might talk a lot about the U.S. Department of Education. As a lifelong educator, this is one of the federal agencies I spent a lot of time thinking and, I will admit, complaining about. Nothing against the people who are in the U.S. Department of Education. They're good people. We just have to assume that. They work in a system that has corrupted education. And I mean that in an economic sense. I mean it in a cultural sense. And it's done it because there's no right given the government, the federal government, to be involved in education. No right whatsoever. I happen to be one of those dinosaurs who knows the Constitution, and there's this part of the Constitution I'll talk about that enumerates, it lists the powers for Congress, and nowhere is that power granted. And I happen to think that it's perfectly fine to follow rules, at least some rules, that were very popular in the late 18th century. Thank goodness our founders set up a system that was flexible enough to include more people, people of color, women, into the system. But it doesn't have to be so flexible that it actually is useless. And so in what we might call first principles or permanent things, such as enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8, I think it's very important to observe these. Notice I've not until now even mentioned the phrase Common Core. Third, as a consequence, the federal government has become a national government, and this terminology is crucial. If you read Federalist Number 51, one of the most eloquent essays in the Federalist Papers, written, we think, by Madison, he talks about the government not being completely federal and not being completely national. It's a very important distinction. Federalism, simple definition, is shared powers. And our federal system has three levels of government: the federal system in Washington, every state system in state capitals and beyond, and every local system. And it's federated because the founders understood what happened if a concentrated number of people held all the power. So they want to split that power horizontally. But then they also split it vertically by creating a legislative branch, an executive branch, and a judicial branch. So when I teach this to students, I draw a grid, a 3x3 grid, and you can think of this as sort of being split 9 ways. And surely different times in American history, different ones of those 9 units have been a little more powerful than others. Believe it or not, at one point, local governments were the most powerful. And that's probably a good thing. It goes back to Kyle Washit's argument about starting in our communities. But the founders understood you're not going to have a perfect system because this is dealing with humans and all of us are imperfect, some more than others, as we know. But what you can do is hopefully get a majority of those representatives, a majority of those public officials who are virtuous in the classic sense, which means they put the common good above their self-interest. And if one of them is mistaken or one of them is a demagogue, that will generally be offset by the others. And that's why the system works. And that's also why change for most of our country's history has been long in coming, because there is an inherent gridlock in the system. And I'm someone who, since I first started being a political conservative, which was about day one of my life, have thought that gridlock is a good thing. Let us, as individuals, do our thing. Always understanding that morality has to be a part of that. And there is a role for government. But let us do that. This has also led to a terrible misconception, which is that we live in a democracy. And we don't. We live in a republic. And people on both sides of the political spectrum use the word democracy. It's very popular. And I think in most cases, it's innocuous. It's just innocent. But it just drives me nuts because it's not true. We live in a representative democracy, which is a republic. And the founders were very purposeful about doing this. Why? Because they said, although this is counterintuitive, it cuts against our common sense, a democracy actually leads to less liberty. Why? Because in democracies, you have majority rule and only majority rule. There is no incentive for the majority to listen to the minority, broadly defined. And there also is no check on that majority, because majority rule is the goal. In a republic, what's the goal? The common good. Justice, order, and liberty. And in order to understand that, you have to be virtuous. What do democracies create? Demagogues. And what do demagogues do? They tell you they love your liberty, but they take it from you. And we can go all through history with one major exception, and that's Athens, and look at failed democracies. And the more I hear about attempts to change the Constitution to make us more of a democracy than a republic, I shudder. Because here we are, a republic, and we're already seeing some of the problems of people wanting to lurch the republic into a democracy. And finally, it is crucial to mention that what has accelerated this devolution, and I think it is in fact a devolution, this is the pessimistic part of the talk, is money. Money is not intrinsically evil. And contrary to popular opinion, serving the common good by creating a profitable business and having a surplus of capital is not only not evil, it's a good. It's an intrinsic good. All of Judeo-Christian tradition, all of it, points to that. What are the two purposes of business? Serve the common good, which a business does by answering a demand in the marketplace, treating its employees well. Almost all businesses do that. And secondly, it creates a profit that can also be used for enhancing the common good. And so this is not a comment about money. It's not even a comment about money in political campaigns. I happen to think that that's a good thing because it's free speech. But I understand if some of you in this room would like to get rid of all the money in political campaigns and in politics, I would just tell you what Madison or Hamilton would tell us if they were here tonight. Do a better job of winning elections. Be more persuasive. Educate students better. Be more active. The money's out there to do it. If you can't beat them, join them. Right? Now, are there exceptions to the rule. Are there people, representatives who have deaf ears? Are there lobbyists who are just really the lowest life form on earth? Sure. But gosh, there are college presidents who might fit that example too, that category. It's any of us. We're sinners. Our nature's fallen. So I think we have to be careful wanting to point the finger at other people. And let's just point it back at us and say, what can we do in order to effect change? And I would encourage us to stop focused so much on the money of campaigns and focus more on the money of the federal government. That's where the problem is. That's what's accelerated the problem. What do I mean? Well, there are a couple of problems here. Take a dollar out of your wallet and send it to Washington, D.C., and you get 17 cents back. That's the worst investment you can ever make. It's worse even than a brand new car, which, of course, depreciates 25% the minute you drive it off the lot. Nothing against car dealers. We love them at Wyoming Catholic College. But the government is a terrible example of how to put a dollar to use. So let's say that all of us in this room, as I'm sure is the case, want to help neighbors in need. And some people may define that in a good Wyoming way just as helping a neighbor. Others of us may see it as a Christian duty. Doesn't really matter. We're innately wired that way, regardless of what stripe of religion you belong to. We're wired that way. And if you aren't wired that way, there's probably something wrong with you, but we can talk about that another day. Let's just give the dollar to the person. And then let's teach them, once their needs are met, then let's teach them how to make their own dollar. But no, we send a dollar through the mail in an inefficient system called the U.S. Postal Service, and then it goes to Washington, D.C., where 83 cents disappear, and we get 17 cents back. For what? To give to the neighbor. It makes no sense, just on a common sense level. But what the federal government has done is dramatically increase its size. I'll talk about that in the key statistics part of the lecture. And it uses that money as blackmail. Now, is everything the federal government does inefficient and evil? No. But all kidding aside, increasingly I have to strain to think about those things that it's at least a model of efficiency for. And nothing against the individuals there. Nothing against any of you if you work in a government agency. Not at all. This is not about the human beings there. It's about the system. So let's look at some key statistics. I could really make you frustrated and negative and pessimistic about the future by only giving you numbers, but I'm just going to give you three. The first is talking about the problem of money in government from the federal government. If you take all 50 states and you add up the state revenue each year, at least for the last fiscal year that concluded for all the states on June 30th of this year, 37%, so more than one-third, 37% of all state revenues come from the federal government. It's blackmail. And what makes it doubly bad is it's our money. It's our dollars that went there. And then they were turned into a quarter. And then they've got to tax us more, so they can turn it into two dimes, and then tax us more, so they can turn it into a nickel. It just makes no sense. We have brilliant economists who've studied this. They don't subscribe to one ideology, the other. These are just very sharp economists. The most famous of them is Arthur Laffer. And he talks about the behavior of economics, the behavior of taxation. And it makes no sense to be sending it afar. The other thing it's done is it's prevented you and me from helping our neighbor, because we assume that someone else is going to do it. And you know what that does? It actually diminishes the dignity of ourselves. Because, and I'm not even talking about getting to heaven, although that's one thing we ought to be concerned about. I'm talking about in this life doing one of the things we are wired to do in nature, which is to help other people. Because you know what? It might be us one day. And that is one of the definitions of a community that works together. It doesn't mean we agree on everything. Heck, we could even disagree on a lot. But it doesn't mean that we need to help each other. And so it's evil in that regard. And that's what these economists who study the behavior of taxation or the behavior that taxation produces study. In Wyoming, by the way, that statistic of which percentage of our state budget comes from the federal government is lower. It's 26%. But it was half that less than 10 years ago. The second statistic I will give you is a historical one. In 1800, there were 125 federal employees. In 1800, there were 125 federal employees. That does not include the 5,000 men who were in the Army and Navy. In 2014, on Monday afternoon of this week, we had 3 million federal employees. It gets worse. I love to play with numbers to give them maximum impact, and I think I'm about to do that for you. So, in 1800, 125 federal employees, that was one employee for every 42,000 Americans. We have a lot of people now, 330 million people. One employee for every 110 Americans. And if you either own a business or you're close enough to the running of a business, or for that matter, even a nonprofit charity, you feel that. You feel that. Particularly if you think about 2014 versus 2004 and 2004 versus 1994, and you just keep going back every 10 years. You feel that. It's expensive in terms of its economic cost, but I would say it's far more expensive in human cost because it absolutely accentuates that notion. It makes that notion worse that someone else is going to deal with the problem. We'll let the auditor catch it. We'll let the federal bank auditor come by and just make sure our books are okay. Every industry, every business, from banking to construction to education, feels this. And number three, speaking of education, let me pick on the U.S. Department of Education a little bit. The U.S. Department of Education was formed in 1979. How could an executive-level agency be created when the power didn't exist to do so in the Constitution? Because we live in a period in which those things happen. And because some people were very good at demagoguing the issue, frankly, and saying that if you love children, and if you love teachers, and if you love the United States of America and don't want it to fall behind the Soviets in math and science and reading, then we have to have a federal Department of Education that ensures that education is going to be good. Now, I would run for the hills from that argument. But let's just say they were right in their premise in 1979. In 2014 dollars, the U.S. Department of Education spent $11 billion of our dollars. Its budget for the upcoming year is $88 billion. Eight times as much. Now, have we seen educational quality improve by an order of eight? Because in what I do every day, if I spend money, I need to make sure that it, in fact, is doing what it's supposed to be doing. And if it doesn't, and we make those mistakes, and we ought to let bureaucrats make a mistake now and then, we're accountable to it, right? And we go back and say, well, I'm never doing that again. No. In fact, what's happened to math and science and reading scores is that they have gone down. And so I remember my high school logic class. That tells me that spending more federal dollars on education actually makes education worse. But see, if you were to make that argument, you would be in Rick Perry's situation in 2009. You hate kids. You hate teachers. You hate education. You must be from the South and want to go back to the Civil War. I use the example of Detroit, which is just a wonderful place that has terrible circumstances. How much do we spend per year? And I say we because there are a lot of federal dollars there, per pupil in Detroit. $27,000. I once started a private school in Louisiana, and I tell you, if I could have charged $27,000 per year for tuition, the quality of education we would have had. But you know what? It doesn't cost that much. It costs about a quarter of that. And what's most important is that parents be involved and teachers not be brainwashed by dynamics I'll talk about later, and that you have administrators who are willing to do what? To experiment. Every school is different. We ought not have this cookie-cutter system that we're trying to set up. Every child is different. But also there are some basic expectations that almost everyone should be able to meet. The second highest per pupil spending in the entire world is also in the United States, Washington, D.C. And by every objective measure, so every organization that wants the best for Washington, D.C. and Detroit, particularly for the kids in those schools and the teachers who, God bless them, are doing the work of the Lord, I think. By every objective measure, those are the worst schools in educational quality and in social safety in the world. In the world. Which is a real shame, because as Americans, that ought to be a source of pride for us, that every school, whether it's private or public or religious or not religious, be doing well. And for those of us who are educators, it definitely sort of punches us in the gut, even if we directly have nothing to do with that. So I think the statistics are condemning of this system. And so the historical context is very important. You ought to be asking yourself, well, Kevin, at what point did this become bad? At what point did things get so bad that they accelerated and we sort of feel like we have the snowball going downhill? So very briefly, I want to cover these points in the historical context so that we can have plenty of time for question and answer. I want to step back from our American context and talk about something in the Middle Ages. And that is the principle of subsidiarity. A very fancy word that means something very simple. Let the lowest unit closest to a problem fix the problem. My wife reminds me of this all the time. We have four relatively young kids, and, you know, dad's dad, and they're having an argument, and I'll bark, you know, be quiet. And if they aren't quiet, then I'll go over there and I'll break them up, you know, sort of like the boxing referee. And she says, Kevin, you've got to let them solve the problem on their own, because otherwise, when they're 37 and 57, they'll be calling you and wanting you to fix it. And I don't like that idea. So that's subsidiarity, right? Women, as they always are right. And I mean that, absolutely, in this case. That is kind of a fun example that is very relevant to subsidiarity, because that's the what our founders understood. It is, in the 21st century context, often articulated by Catholic bishops, but it's not an exclusively Catholic concept. This is something that plenty of non-Catholics articulate, especially increasingly with federal government overreach, but this is something that is part of our political tradition. James Madison and George Washington and Thomas Jefferson never used the word subsidiarity that I'm aware of, but they discussed the principle a lot, because it's kind of common sense. Are there situations when you need to have a higher power come in, an officer, a law enforcement officer, or a mayor, or sometimes the President of the United States? Sure. But those are really few and far between when you think about it. I think about my native state, Louisiana, following Hurricane Katrina. A terrible human tragedy, obviously. What was almost as bad as the human tragedy was the immediate, automatic reaction that the federal government ought to come in and fix the problem. And you've read the stories. I actually know plenty of people who said, all of that water, you know, everyone's very generous sending water, all that stuff coming from Washington, D.C., will take 6 or 7 weeks to get there. We're going to get in our truck, we'll be in New Orleans in 2 hours, and we're going to help these people. Subsidiarity. The people closest to the problem, who have great, generous hearts, want to help. And could there be some system, some agency that kind of coordinates that? Sure, down the road, but in the first several days, people will take care of their neighbors. What was equally egregious, too, was that the state government wanted to default to the federal government. Why can't the state handle that? Because it has become a dependent state on federal money. So it's a very difficult problem to unravel, to solve. But subsidiarity would be important to keep in mind. By the way, several weeks later, in a different part of the state and in southeast Texas, when Hurricane Rita hit, the response was entirely different. You might know that from the national news, but once they realized that, they sort of left it alone. People responded. They wanted government out. And by that point, the governor of Louisiana had sort of figured out that there was a better way of handling this. The governor of Texas, it sounds like I'm advocating his candidacy for president. I'm not. Nor am I not. It's just being objective. We're a 501c3 organization, so just want to be clear about that. But he responded well. He responded very well, just like governors who are Democrats have responded well to mining accidents. It's not an exclusively Republican thing. It's a human thing. So subsidiarity is very important to restore. Secondly, sovereignty. I told you earlier in the talk that I wanted to come back to that concept. Another kind of fancy word, and what it means is the right to govern oneself. Each one of us is sovereign. Each one of us is sovereign. And we come together in this hypothetical concept called the state of nature that some of the Enlightenment philosophers talk about, and these philosophers, of course, impacted our founders. And you might think sometimes there's a real state of nature, but it really is just a philosophical concept. But it's helpful because if we just sort of freeze time, which we can't do, but let's pretend we can, we freeze time, and there's no government, there's no civil society, each one of us comes together and says, you know what, if I have a problem with my neighbor and there isn't a neutral arbiter, there isn't a neutral judge, if he looks at my cow wrong, I can do all kinds of things. And that's the definition of liberty, going all the way to the point of doing whatever we want. That's not liberty. That's anarchy. Sovereignty says we want to give up, or mandates that we give up just a little bit of our liberties, a little bit of our rights, along with our neighbors, to create civil society. And the reason we do that is not because we want less liberty, but because we want more. We actually have more liberty, we have more rights, we have greater latitude in our rights when we organize ourselves, because we have a common understanding of what's expected. Because remember, we ought not talk about rights and forget that they come with duties. We shouldn't talk about rights and forget that they come with obligations. And when we put those obligations together and we start helping neighbors rather than sending our dollar to D.C. to have it turned into a quarter, we enhance our liberty because we're helping one another. And keep in mind that government's first job is not to keep us safe. That is a misconception that has become doubly worse since 9/11. And nothing against the response to 9/11. It's just that's when it's happened. It's not government's first job. Government's first job is to guarantee our liberties. Otherwise, in that state of nature, we should not have given them any of it, right? Go form another government. So, I hope I'm being clear and beginning to connect some of these dots for us. The origins of sovereignty, of course, are God. I have a couple of atheist friends. My atheist friends tend to become Catholic, but, you know, that's just a way of saying if you're an atheist, you may want to be careful about talking to me. Just a joke. I say that for my two remaining atheist friends who are great men. One day. At least Methodist. I mean, it's just something Christian. Let's just say you're an atheist. You say, Kevin, I don't believe in God. Okay, nature. They come from nature. But nature comes from God. We can agree on that. We're a pluralistic society. That's fine. And actually, for those of us who are very serious about our Christianity in the public square and that scares people, we ought to be savvy enough, and I mean savvy in the best sense of that word, not negative, to have conversations without always resorting to faith. And I don't mean to betray Christianity at all. But we ought in the public square to be able to have these arguments in terms of natural law, so that someone who just shuts down completely when they hear God can maybe perk up a little bit. And then in the second round, we can talk about God. So we need to be, I think, a little more savvy about that. In the polity, which is just the fancy word for the public square, sovereignty rests with the states. It still does. We have recent jurisprudence, recent court cases that say that sovereignty rests with the states. James Madison said in Federalist 40, as you see there, "Do they, the fundamental principles of the nation, require that in the establishment of the Constitution the states should be regarded as distinct and independent sovereigns? They are so regarded by the Constitution proposed." And here Madison is using just a wonderful tactic of rhetoric, which is to preempt what the opposing side is going to ask you and answer it. It's very important for all of us. To some extent, I would imagine each of you is here because you want to be an apologist for liberty, an apologist for ordered liberty in the public square, and I think that that's helpful. And then if the person we're talking to is reasonable and they say no, that's actually not quite the question I would ask, let's listen and let's meet them on their terms and then have a productive debate. And we ought to be able to have a debate in American society without hating one another. But it's very hard to say these things in a wide public audience without people walking away hating you. Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution is one that if you've not read the Constitution in a while, you ought to start with. Because we historians call it the Enumerated Powers Clause. It lists 30, maybe 35, it depends on how you count the powers, 30 powers of Congress. Because Article 1, the first article of the Constitution, talks about the legislative branch. Why? Because the founders thought the legislative branch would be the preserver of liberty. That's generally been true in American history. I wouldn't be so optimistic in the near term. But there are 30. Congress can collect taxes. Congress regulates interstate commerce. Of course, the Constitution talks about that in another clause. Congress will make treaties. It'll authorize treaties that the executive initiates. On and on. These are all very reasonable things. I have no problem with any of that. There ought to be a Congress. There ought to be a federal government. Because there are some disputes that states simply can't settle. But we have gone far afield from those 30 powers. I've cited some examples here. The U.S. Department of Education is a glaring one. There is another one, which we don't think about much anymore, and that is Congress has the right to coin money. It doesn't have the right to print it. And in 1871, when the Attorney General of one state challenged Congress on that because we were beginning to print more money and we're beginning to talk about moving off the gold and silver standard, that case was decided in favor of the state. Why? Because of state sovereignty. Now, we've now interpreted that, for better or for worse, economically. You might notice that Congress and the federal government print money rather than coining real gold and silver. There are persuasive arguments to return to the gold and silver standard. There are persuasive arguments not to. That's not really the point I want to be engaged in, as much as to say that when that issue has come up, after the Civil War, it has been decided on the grounds of the Tenth Amendment. What about the Bill of Rights and the Tenth Amendment itself? I said that the Tenth Amendment has a very important history beyond the obvious, and it is the following. The Federalists, remember, are those men and women who wanted the Constitution to be ratified. The Constitution's written in 1787. It's made public on September 17th. Constitution Day, which we used to celebrate. For some reason, we don't do that anymore. And 2 years later, it was ratified. And the process of ratification was that 9 of the 13 state legislatures had to approve it. 2 years. This is a big debate. And it's a big debate because the Constitution is trying to put two things in balance: liberty and order. Liberty and order. And there are a few different ways you can do that. You could go the way of Britain and have a constitutional monarchy, which is a little more on the side of order. Or you could, as would happen a few years later, see the French Revolution, which in fact had no order and was all the way over here with liberty, unless you were one of the 100,000 or so who were killed. And that's sort of the example of democracy, turning into anarchy, turning into just complete chaos. So the Federalists believed that the Constitution should be ratified as is. The Anti-Federalists, who were also very good, smart men, suggested that it not be ratified because they thought that it gave too much power to the federal government. And so these days, the Anti-Federalists have enjoyed something of a resurgence in popularity, as they should, because they make very good arguments. As I mentioned early on, we've got this high school program at the college, and we just started that. And this week, other than this morning, I've been with those high school students, and we've been going through the Federalist and Anti-Federalist debates. And the person who filled in for me today was Kyle Washington, whom you know. And he wrote to me, and he said, Kevin, I'm sorry, but I think we have a group of Anti-Federalists. So I wrote back and said, don't apologize. It's good to know these debates. The point is, the Anti-Federalists insisted on a Bill of Rights. And they get credit for that, as they should. The Federalists are portrayed in some revisionist textbooks as being opposed to the Bill of Rights because they didn't like individual liberties. And that is the biggest crock of baloney I have heard in a long time. I've seen a lot of bad history textbooks, and in all of them they say that. The Federalists maintained a Bill of Rights was unnecessary. Why? Because every state had a Bill of Rights. And the Federalists, who generally were intellectually honest, said, why would we have the federal government involved in something that it has no right to be involved in? In other words, the Federalists are saying, we're segregating rights from the federal government. The federal government is simply existing to make all of the individual sovereign states work. It has nothing to do with individuals. But the anti-federalists in New York were very strong, as you may know. New York was sort of the swing state, to use our modern language, for ratification. And the Federalists had to give in, but they insisted that the 10th Amendment be added. Why? To clarify a number of things. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution. So there are powers not delegated to the United States, nor prohibited by it to the states. So there are some clauses which prohibit powers to states. Interstate commerce, treaties, generally foreign invasions, although there's one tiny clause that's in the news today about a governor invoking his or her power to call up the National Guard because of the immigration issue, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So for political reasons and probably good ones, they give in, but they get what they really needed, which was for posterity's sake. And keep in mind, our founders were obsessed with posterity because that's what men of magnanimous virtue do and women of magnanimous virtue do. Not for accolades, but because they want their projects to last a long time. For posterity's sake, they want everyone to know there are powers that are reserved to the states and the states are joined to the people. So, understanding that about the Bill of Rights and the Tenth Amendment is crucial. If we were to breeze through history, we would notice that 10 years later, with the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson had to be drafted by the legislatures of those states to write two essays which are potent and eloquent. And they advance something called nullification. The concept of nullification is that if Congress passes a law that a state legislature deems violating their people's rights, they can nullify it. They can declare it void. Now let's just take, if somehow we could, the Civil War out of the picture and all of the things that go along with the Civil War. Slavery in particular is what I'm thinking about. And let's just ask ourselves the question, could that make some sense? Yes, there are drawbacks. You could get a state that really likes nullification and makes the whole union problematic. But the point in the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions is that these are extreme circumstances. But the states have to have these rights in order to protect the liberties of their people. They don't talk about states' rights. They don't talk about state powers. They're talking about the liberties of their people. And good thing, because what prompted this was the passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts, which, among other things, said that if you owned a newspaper, you couldn't say anything negative about the Congress or the president. Now, sometimes I feel as if there's an Alien and Sedition Act, but praise God, we have something called the free market, because the free market has created a demand for right-minded media. And that's why I really want the government out of that regulation. The Virginia and Kentucky resolutions become a very important pillar in the theory of nullification, which, by the way, is used by northern states in 1814 at the Hartford Convention. So this is not an exclusively southern thing. It also is not, at least in most cases, tied to slavery. Sometimes it is. We ought to admit that readily. But most of the time, from 1790s until the 1850s, it isn't. We get John C. Calhoun as Vice President of the United States, who advances the theory of nullification because he hated a tariff law that was passed by Congress and that was supported by his president, Andrew Jackson, who was a fellow South Carolinian, at least by birth. He was elected from Tennessee. And the interesting sidebar on this is that South Carolina actually nullifies the tariff bill. It's the one and only time it's been done in history. And Andrew Jackson says, well, you know what, Vice President Calhoun, I'm going to put my army uniform back on as the commander-in-chief. I am going to ride my horse down to Charleston, and I'm going to convince you, man to man, to end this nullification. Clearly, the president was going to invoke military power to bring South Carolina to a point of retreat. We could have had the Civil War in 1831. Very, very close to that. Well, the South Carolina legislature does two things. Number one, it probably did the prudent thing, which is to rescind the nullification. But the second section of that rescinding of nullification, and I just love this, is they maintain the right to nullify future laws. So these same revisionist textbooks that talk about the Federalists in wrong ways and have us focus on people who were not important in history and take away all of the people who were, will also tell us that with the conclusion of the Civil War, nullification was dead. Well, that's not true. I think secession is at least problematic as a result of the Civil War. But even Abraham Lincoln would say, not use the word secession, he would say, we preserved the Union, we ended slavery, which wasn't his goal until halfway through the war, and a good thing that it became one. And we get three amendments to the Constitution, all of which have to do with the human person. We free the slaves, we make them citizens, and we let the male freed slaves have the right to vote. The women, of course, would get the right to vote in the early 20th century. So if you ask yourself, what did the Civil War accomplish? Those three things. It left open the question of nullification. There was no reason really to deal with that. We have a misunderstanding, too, that the 11 states that seceded had to sign some document that said they could never talk about nullification again. That's just complete hogwash. There's no such document. So be very, very careful about textbooks. To continue the story, and I guess at this point, for Mike's sake, full disclaimer, I am glad that we have a United States of America, so I'm not here to advocate the Confederacy. We go through late 19th and early 20th century jurisprudence, and what happens is all of those things that I just said are proven true. Nullification is possible. Most importantly, a lot of cases are decided in favor of states. Northern states, southern states, western states, eastern states. Sovereignty is very important. This doesn't change, to go back to my question, until the 1930s. And it happens ostensibly because of New Deal programs. But we can't exclusively blame Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, because both Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal were products of the progressive movement, capital P, progressive movement, which starts in the late 1800s. It really begins to rear its head in our classrooms first through Dewey and James. It then begins to rear its head in things like health and human services with some very bad science that wasn't science at all. And then it becomes mainstream political thought that the federal government should solve problems. Well, in order for the federal government to solve problems, it needs more money. And in order to acquire more money, it has to change taxation, which is why we have a dramatic increase in the federal income tax to pay for this growing bureaucracy. And sort of like my example about education quality since 1979, what happens to the unemployment rate from the beginning of the New Deal to the end? It goes up. It goes up. Yet another chapter in those revisionist textbooks is that FDR, who may have been well-intentioned for all I know, I didn't know the guy, I couldn't ask him questions. Let's just say he was. He could also be wrong. There are many well-intentioned people who are just wrong. All of that energy, all of that money, what ends unemployment is the United States entering World War II. And in 18 months, unemployment goes from 27% to 1% because of war production, not because of the New Deal. And in fact, I should say, because I just think I have a moral obligation to say it, that while the stock market crash would have happened regardless, because those things happen every generation, what started the Great Depression was not the stock market crash. It was the federal government with this fairly new system called the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve managers who still didn't understand how to manage an economy, perhaps they've gotten better, but I don't even like the fact that they're managing the economy. They did the exact opposite thing with the money supply that in hindsight we know should have been done, and it actually propelled us into the Great Depression. What if they hadn't done that? Then we would have had something that we had every 25 or 30 years in American history, and it's called a panic. It's a run on money. It's a run on banks. We've made some changes to that, which might make some of us more comfortable. Others of us would be willing to trust the free market and the virtue of people in it, but it's there. If we had simply done that, then we would have in the cyclical way, grown out of the stock market crash, and I believe the unemployment rate would have been back to an equilibrium 3 or 4 years later, because that's what history tells us. We get to the Great Society in the 1960s. In January 1965, as some of you may remember, President Johnson declared a war on poverty. We've spent $17 trillion on the war on poverty, and the poverty rate has gone up. And beyond that, out of great love for everyone who needs assistance, then and now, it's evil. Because in most of their cases, so accepting those people with developmental disabilities and so on who will just need our permanent help and we ought to help them, accepting those, half of 1% of the population that's received the $17 trillion, we've actually diminished their dignity as human people. Because God wires us to work. He wires us to incentive. I have no problem with some innovative programs that came out in the 1990s with helping people to transition into understanding that. But what's happened to those programs? Some of the most successful experiments in public policy in our history, and they're no longer funded. So on that point, if that's kind of your cause, there's some hope at the state level, at a lot of states, and I think that might be one place where we can focus our attention. And so what's happened, if you look at this diagram that I've put at the bottom of the page for you, is that we've moved from a system in which we have kept liberty and order in balance to a system in which, as government power has increased, federal government power has increased, and state powers have been diminished, we have this concept of liberty as doing whatever we want. And that's not the definition of liberty. The definition of liberty is the freedom to do what we ought. The freedom to do what we ought. Which means we have rights, but we also have obligations, because that word ought is fraught with a lot of duties. And someone can push back and say, gosh, that sounds kind of religious. Well, that same person probably thinks that Thomas Jefferson didn't believe in God, and I can tell you that he gives us that definition. Liberty is the freedom to do what we ought. So with that in mind, let's fight defeatism. Let's think about some possible solutions. As Professor Washit would argue, we need to be involved in our local communities. There are some people who are interested in this topic who say, I just never, ever want to volunteer for a political campaign. I certainly never want to run for office. You don't have to do those things. Be involved in charitable organizations in your community. Know your neighbors. There's this pretty famous poet, Wendell Berry. You may read some of his things. He's not entirely right-minded on some public policies, but let's just accept him as a poet. And that's his big thing, is know your neighbor, love your neighbor, sit on your porch with your neighbor, even if you vote for different people, because that gives us an understanding of what freedom is. Freedom is very restrained, but it shouldn't be restrained by government. It should be restrained by our obligations we feel, and we love, actually, those obligations for one another. But for those of you who are interested in politics and you don't necessarily want to run for president in 2016, run for your city council. Or if you're involved in one of the political parties, run for your party's organizing committee. It's just a great way to be involved in the public square. And absolutely, if the Lord's calling you to be even more involved, run for the state legislature. We have a great temporary or part-time citizen legislature in Wyoming, and more states should learn from it. The exact opposite is Louisiana, which is one of the many reasons I'm happy to be in Wyoming. What about state action? On the point of being involved, we need to be sure, particularly in this election year, that any man or woman who's running for office whom we're thinking of supporting can have an intelligent conversation on these issues. Because they've got to know this before they can articulate it, right? And we don't want them to be mere puppets. We don't want them to say, oh, okay, I want your vote, so I'll talk about this. Engage them in a conversation, politely and cheerfully. And look, maybe they were accountants and they just didn't study this. Suggest very politely, well, here's some reading that you can do on this, and I'm happy to answer questions. We need to build a friendship with them too. And look, if they get into the office they're in, we might disagree with them occasionally. That's okay, as long as it's not a huge sort of, in my case, moral issue. But even then, we have an obligation to go talk to them. And we shouldn't just shun them and say, yeah, I'm done with you. We need to be developing really strong relationships. as Kyle Washit would remind us. But it would also be important at the state level to keep alive the possibility of a state saying, no, we're not going to follow that federal law. I'm a real fan of Sun Tzu's Art of War, not because I think we need to go to war, but because it gives us a lot of tips about human relationships, about politics. And one of the things, one of the points he makes is, and of course this is 3,000 years ago, 3,500 years ago, if you can't win the battle you're in, buy time. We wouldn't have the United States of America if George Washington had not read that. He loses 27 battles. The ones he won were the most important. He bought time. Sometimes by the skin of his teeth, but he bought time. And so if you feel as if we're in a battle, we're in a culture war, and we're losing, don't give up. Buy time. And we buy time by having great friends. The college hopes that it's helping by perhaps helping to inspire some of these communities, even in a very mild way. And we're not going anywhere. So in Wyoming, we'll keep motivating you, I hope. Maybe sometimes we'll say something you disagree with. That's okay. You might believe something I disagree with. But we can be friends. And at the national level, there are a couple of specific things I would encourage you to read about. One of them is solutions. One of them is repealing the 17th Amendment. The 17th Amendment passed and ratified in the early 1900s changed how U.S. senators were selected. It used to be, because of how the Constitution was written, until the 1910s, that U.S. senators were selected by the state legislature. And this fits with our understanding of a republic. Because if we understand that we're in a republic, we believe that certain men and women are called to that life of public service. The founders thought they were called to maybe 8 years or 12 years, not really long time. But we can talk about that later. And so if that's the case, and we trust some of them to be our representatives in our state legislature, aren't they better equipped than you and I are to decide which two people in the state should represent the state in the U.S. Senate? Madison said the Senate is sort of like the saucer of the teacup. There's hot liquid in that cup. Take the spoon, put some of the tea in the saucer, which actually is how British would drink tea in the late 18th century, and it cools off. That's the Senate. Inherent gridlock is a good thing. We get caught up in this idea that government always has to do things. We shouldn't. We're the ones who should do things. The second is what's called an Article 5 convention. And I'm happy to report that a number of members of our Wyoming state legislature support this idea. You go to Article 5 of the Constitution, and there you will read just a pretty hefty paragraph about amending the Constitution. And you're familiar, probably more familiar, with the typical way, which has been done 27 times, where three-quarters of the states ratify a proposed amendment. Sometimes that's taken 3 years. In one case, the 27th Amendment, it took 208 years. Because it's just as long as one of the states has already ratified, it doesn't rescind it. It's there. It's live. Well, an Article 5 convention would be a new constitutional convention. If only 2/3 of state legislatures endorse such an action. Now, you'll probably go home and do some searching on the internet for an Article 5 convention, and you'll see some information and some misinformation. The misinformation would tell you, as best as I can tell, that we've had the requisite number of states endorse an Article 5 convention. That's not true. It's one thing for a group of people in the state legislature to say we would support this, as happened 2 weeks ago in California, where the Liberal Democratic Caucus endorsed an Article 5 convention. This is a big deal because this has been a largely conservative effort for 30 years. Well, they actually have to vote on it. So until we get 34 state legislatures to do that, there will not be an Article 5 convention. Are there risks with an Article 5 convention? Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm encouraging you to learn more about that and decide for yourself if that's a solution you want to sign on for. So in conclusion, we need to know what subsidiarity is, practice that in our own lives, and get our representatives to know what it is, to talk about it. Secondly, knowing more about subsidiarity is designed to restore state sovereignty, or at least a belief in it, which will give us a proper understanding of the human person, because ultimately government exists, as you remember, to guarantee our liberty. And the reason we want liberty is to order it for civil society so that we can fulfill God's or nature's promise for each of us. Thanks for listening. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.